And in our deep dive this week, we're going to be taking a look at what it takes to make a quality business, or what you should be looking out for as an investor looking for quality businesses. I have the privilege of welcoming one of our good friends into studio, Keith McLachlan. He is an asset manager, portfolio manager, and a market commentator that we've known for quite a number of years. Keith, thanks so much for coming through. Thanks for joining us. Simon and I have loosely kind of played around with things around valuations and conversations around what goes into the thinking and all of that. But what makes a quality business?
So let me stand back and answer the question you haven't asked. Why does that matter? Now, as an investor, our job is to allow capital to compound through time. Position it as optimally as possible. And there's a lot of talk about positioning and where to invest and everything, but there isn't enough talk about time. And, you know, to quote Warren Buffett, time is the friend of a good business and the enemy of a mediocre one. Likewise, hold companies forever. But then Buffett is selling Bank of America and Apple and everything. So not even Buffett listens to Buffett. But the gist is correct. Now, you know, narcissisms and everything aside, what is the reality? And the reality is, if you have a look at ignore the Dow Jones, that's a Frankenstein of an index.
It is. It is the craziest nonsense ever.
Awful. But have a look at the S&P 500. Started in 1950. So we're in 2024 now, 75 odd years, almost a century. How many of the companies in the original 500 are still in it? Five.
Wow.
Companies don't survive in the long term. Very, very few. In less than 100 years, 99% of S&P 500 has fallen out and or does not exist anymore. And therefore, to provide sufficient time for your capital to compound in investing in the equity space, the starting point has to be to invest in good companies, because then you're shifting the weighting in your favor, because bad companies, it's just a matter of time until they hit the wall. If not this year, next year, 10 years time, 20 years time, but starting at quality and asking the question, is this a good business? Before even worrying about valuation and other things, at least gives you a little bit more odds that your capital will have the time to compound.
So by that logic, we should be investing in Japanese companies. Most of them are 100 years old plus.
Well, yeah.
They built some of the longest standing companies.
And some Scandinavians. And weirdly, I mean, you're right in the Japanese, absolutely. And Keith, I like your point, because I remember when I was getting into markets in the sort of 80s, early 90s, and there were two stocks at every portfolio. You bought it first and then you decided next. In the US, it was GM. We know how that worked. And locally, it was Anglo-American. And you know, at least Anglo-American sort of hasn't gone borderline bankrupt, but neither survived. But then Japanese companies. But then I'm trying to think. I mean, what are the – I mean, you know, I can't even pronounce half of them. Okay.
Well, interesting fact. There's 52,000 companies in Japan that are more than 100 years old.
Jeez. There's probably also 52 million people over 100 years old.
So, yeah, the Japanese stock market is interesting. You hit a lot of those investor relations websites and they aren't even English translated.
Nah, I know.
So,
yeah.
You know, when they talk about investing in your circle of competence, that is not ours.
Okay, so we understand that time is essential to look at this, but it's also essential to identify what would be good quality or to stand the test of time, so to speak. What else are we looking at here?
Okay, so let me answer it this way. All businesses on earth solve one or more problems. They either solve a consumer's problem, they solve a government's problem, they solve other businesses' problem. All you got to do to start a business is find a problem, solve it, and charge someone for it. And that's why all successful businesses exist. In economics, we call that utility. So if you build a mental model, ignoring the real world and just imagining what the perfect business is, the perfect business takes the least amount of inputs and through process or whatever, generates the maximum amount of outputs, utility, that sells it to the largest possible market with the least price sensitivity, with the least number of competitors, and the least number of substitute products or services or whatever they do. It's quite simple. That's what the best business is. Now, in the listed space, someone is managing that for you. So insert a governance and a management layer, and hopefully they're trustworthy and they're great and everything, and there's proper continuity in terms of the governance, and then you start to be onto something. That's what a good business is.
So that's services, right? Because you talk around the least amount of input. I mean, make a piece of software, I'm done. I was also going to say retail until you said it. These services can have some IP and protect themselves.
Retail is very easy to replicate and duplicate, and competition and all of that.
There's pros and cons in all of these things. And services sound like it, except don't forget your business can walk out the door.
Yeah.
Because if your business is your payroll, one, That means your factory is flowing through your income statement every single year. Mm. And second of all, your factory isn't in one place and therefore can be poached.
Depends what they always can. I mean, I can switch from Microsoft Office to Libre, which is free. Have been able to do it for 20 years, haven't done it. You're right. Yeah. They can walk. It depends. You know, in some sense, as a mobile operator, you've got perhaps less, but if you are embedded like CrowdStrike, I mean, I can't wait for the next set of CrowdStrike numbers to see how many people actually left after CrowdStrike's shut down planet Earth.
I don't think it's going to be as many as people think.
I think it's going to be hardly none.
I think it's going to be like two, maybe
because
three
like
companies.
Because the mission of pulling out CrowdStrike, critical infrastructure at the core of your computers, replacing it with stuff you don't know, and it's awkward and it's not lacquer, but like
something that's untested, something that's untried. So I think where you mention that it is service related, or where we conclude that it is kind of service oriented, Simon's point is to say, build a service that is irreplaceable, build a service that people wouldn't want to move away from, even if they had the alternative option to move away from. So like CrowdStrike, if I have the option, or I have the option to move into Linux, I have the option to migrate from one service or one platform or even one product to another. But brand loyalty and reputation that comes with that should be something that people consider, obviously, when building a business.
So I don't want to emphasize services over any particular business model. We can chat through different ones. But a good way of solving the problem of what a good business is, you know, to quote Charlie Munger, is invert the problem. Don't look in the listed space. Look what businesses are so good, people refuse to list them because they want to keep the profits all to themselves. And some of the biggest businesses in the world are legal firms, accounting firms, audit firms.
Yeah.
Think about that, consultancies.
Yeah. Accountants and lawyers. Hey?
just food for thought. Like, invert the problem and you see where the good businesses are. But all of that said, I mean, a way to think about it is, and the difference between, for the listeners, the difference between barriers to entry and competitive advantages is barriers to entry are things that exist that prevent new entrants coming into an industry. And then once you're in the industry,
you're protected,
competitive advantages are how you compete versus the other guys in the industry. Mm. And really, really good businesses have strong barriers to their industry, and they have particularly strong competitive advantages against their peers. And that's how you win. You know, shifting out of services and have a look at banking. How did Capitec take a third of the banking market?
They offered a better service than their existing competitors once they got into that space.
And before they started, if someone had come to you and said, I want to start a retail bank in South Africa, what would you have told them?
Would have laughed.
Mm. Would have laughed. Mm. You said, guys, there's four big players here. They've got this market wrapped up. What are you doing?
Now, Capitec is not part of the big five. It has unseated some of the big players there. I think, if I'm not mistaken, on customers, they have the largest number of customers of any.
They're approaching third place.
They're approaching third place on market cap.
But here's a quick thing to go down a rabbit hole. If you look at the adverts, the traditional big banks all now going private banking. Driving around last evening, Nedbank, Standard Bank, FNB, all selling private banking. In other words, they're going up the curve, and they're basically saying to Capitec, you've won. Best bank is yours.
We will not compete there.
It's worth exploring. How did they win? Banking is very complicated. In the back-end systems, in my auditing career, at the start of my career, one of my clients was a bank that will remain nameless. And they were doing a core banking system migration. By the end of my articles, they were still doing it. In fact, I got the sense that at some point they're just going to go no and put it back on the shelf and stick with it. But anyway, remain nameless. But banking legacy systems are serious and they're big. And our big banks, I mean, Absa is a Frankenstein. It's an amalgamated banks. Hmm. I mean, who knows how many IT systems they're running in the back?
They still got ledgers in the basement.
Absolutely. Someone sitting
pen,
there.
Pen, paper, ledgers. No, not even that. Like, they're so proud of their 150-year heritage, but it means there's a 150-year-old ledger in the basement somewhere. Oh.
And Capitec, when they started, got to architecture from zero. They opened with cloud. There's one data center sitting in, I think it's out in Stellenbosch. They might have moved it or might have grown, but the original one was out there, and they plug everything in. So when Standard Bank or Nedbank or Absa rolls out a branch, they have to put in servers, they have to put in this, put in that.
They just link something to the cloud.
Exactly. Capitec just rolls it out and plugs in an internet connection.
If they don't like it, if they don't like the CrowdStrike, all they do is take their entire cloud infrastructure, migrate one unit onto something else.
Every branch,
everything else is done all over again.
Which means that they can sell an account at a much lower fee.
Yeah.
efficiency
and actually make a higher profit margin on it. Yeah. And that's what cost to income ratio is. That's what Capitec's advantage was. That's how they won.
You mentioned something, Keith, around management and around leadership. And we spoke about this. Actually, I spoke about this with Pietri last week when Simon was away on holiday enjoying the beach.
At the beach. Dude, this time last week, I was actually finished my swim. I was thinking about where to have bunny chow.
So Pietri and I spoke about this last week. We were chatting about Sasol and we got into a conversation around Simon Baloyi being the new CEO. We've put it up on our socials on TikTok and it's actually like there's a lot of commentary and conversation around it. I made the point to say that South African businesses thrive more than businesses anywhere else in the world for a couple of reasons. And one of those reasons was a good management team that understands the organization that they are leading or the products that they're providing the market. And we went through a couple of examples. We went through how stable someone like First Rand handled their leadership transition versus how choppy, to say, for lack of a better
word. Governance can be a competitive advantage.
That's it, right? So for lack of a better phrasing, six CEOs in 5 years at APSA versus a smooth transition from Alan Pullinger to Mary Vilagazi is a very clear testament of what stability in governance can do for a business.
And take that with Pick and Pay and ShopRite.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Had to bring back the previous set of stability in the case of Pick and Pay that was Sean Summers, went through a period that wasn't so stable, had to bring back stability and say, can we reset and go back to...
But as an investor, that's hard to see.
Well, let me phrase this as iceberg theory, where at the surface level, these large, big listed corporates, all you see is, you know, a CEO, FD, maybe one or two heads of business if they roll them out from, you know, behind the woodwork. And that's who you basically get to meet in the IR team. If there's problems there, how big are the problems lower down? Because whatever you're seeing in the public market is best foot forward. It's always best foot forward.
So and if you're seeing problems in best foot forward, then what?
Oh my gosh, it must be a nightmare in the background.
So where there's smoke, there's likely to be a fire.
Absolutely. So take that and extrapolate it across the whole body. Sasol's a good example. Sasol's problem is the bleeding out of old engineering skills. So if you go to Secunda Sasolburg, do you know that there's pamphlets that in the local newspapers, there's adverts from Saudi Arabia. They're building chemical complexes there. And they're stealing our talent because we have some of the top chemical oil and gas engineers in that space. We managed to convert coal magically into petrol effectively. I mean, that still blows my mind. It's basically magic. They're stealing our guys. Like the talent is bleeding out and that's hard to replace.
To be fair, I wouldn't be mad if it was the oil oligarchs stealing the oil expertise. It kind of makes sense. It lines up with their brand. It lines up with their business. It makes sense. I want to wrap up by looking at from a company perspective and from a numbers perspective. We go through all sorts of data. We go through PE ratios. We look at balance sheets. We look at all these things. What are the simple things that we look at to identify a good business? Simon's got a very good formula for it, and he'll say it again in a second, but I want to get your thoughts on that.
So I'm going to run through this quickly. A business's profitability, liquidity, solvency, and growth. And I consider growth one of the quality metrics. Profitability is broken up into pricing power, which we call gross margin, and efficiency of operations, which we call operating profit margin. That aside, liquidity is cash flow. How much free cash flow can you generate? Maximum. Solvency is you need to be able to run this business without debt. And particularly when I talk about a combination of profit and solvency, I don't like return on equity. I can make a return on equity in the business look like anything.
Mirror almost did that at Transnet.
Absolutely. Just buy back shares in the market, use debt to do it, and you collapse equity and you raise debt and bang, you've got your target return on equity. So I look at return on assets. That is immensely hard to fake. And that means every rand that you're pulling in, how much rand when you put it into an asset does it generate? So that's the combination between that. And that better be higher than your financing cost, thus you're destroying value. And then growth is a key metric as well. And it's growth on the important things. Is your GP margin holding up and or growing? Operating profit margin holding up and or growing? Top line, growing faster than inflation. All of these things, and that's what combines into effectively, in my opinion, running through an income statement, cash flow, and balance sheet. Those are the things you look at.
Simon, we did this with Chantel at the start of our pod, and you've got a very simplified explanation to it.
I've got two, because all that Keith says is true. But for me, a company must make cash, and I could read a cash flow statement, or I could just go look at the dividend. So Warren Buffett said there's two things you know that are true in a financial statement, the dividend and the page number. Everything else is numbers and numbers. Mine was when the PE is kind of like the dividend yield. And we've got so many of those in the market these days, you know, 8 PE, 8 dividend yield. And let's be clear, it's not just the little CMHs and the like. It was our banks. Our banks were, you know, 8 PEs, in fact, 9, 10 dividend yields. It doesn't happen often, and it sometimes could just actually, and there's an example where there was a stock, and I can never remember what it was called, but I remember the CFO was Connie, and then she was at another company, and they both went bust.
Alliance Mining.
Alliance Mining, that was it. Yeah. And they had a PE of 1 and a dividend yield of 10, and they never published results again.
Very, very interesting thoughts. Very interesting reflections. I think there's a lot more to unpack around the valuation space, around the identifying value or looking for value within companies. And it's always difficult when you see so much value, as Simon says, there's so much value out there in the market at the moment. How do you choose? How do you start to, okay, this is where I'm going to put the money, or okay, this is what I'm doing. Something, again, if we're, today seems to be the day we're quoting Buffett and Munger. And if you don't understand what the business does, stay away from the business, right?
Just because a game exists doesn't mean you have to play it. Just because a stock exists doesn't mean you have to.
And that's the beauty of the, and I think this is another Munger or Buffett one. Like, you can just pass on every pitch. You can look at 100 stocks and say, no, thanks. You're not forced to play.
You're not forced to play. And just because a stock exists, you're not forced to buy it either. That's the deep dive, and we'll leave it there.